Hey there, Getting in the Loop listeners. Ever wondered what can be done in your industry to help create a more circular economy? To mark the one-year anniversary of the Getting in the Loop podcast, I've put together a short ebook to help you navigate key circular trends in textiles and apparel, ICT and electronics, and packaging. And it includes links to related reports as well as relevant Getting in the Loop podcast episodes. It's yours to receive when you join up to our podcast newsletter at circularsectors.gettinginthelooppodcast.com. So head over to our website to get your copy of the Circular Sectors Navigator. That's again, circularsectors.gettinginthelooppodcast.com. Hi, I'm Katie Whelan, and join me each week as I talk with experts around the globe about circular economy. You'll find out what's being done to make it a reality, and if it can really solve the problems it promises. It's time for Getting in the Loop. I thought today that I would start us off with a little bit of a different intro, because I'm always saying, welcome back. If you're new here, welcome to the Getting in the Loop podcast, and of course, a big welcome back to all of our recurring listeners. Today, we're talking about the future of flexible packaging with Graham Holder, who is Managing Director of Sloop Consulting. Sloop has been offering consulting services and tools in the field of packaging and sustainability since 2009. And prior to that, Graham worked for Unilever for 23 years, with a wide range of responsibilities including R&D, packaging management and design, supply chain restructuring, and sustainability. In today's episode, Graham and I talk about CFLEX, which stands for A Circular Economy for Flexible Packaging. Graham is the founder and project coordinator for CFLEX, which is a collaborative initiative by over 150 companies and associations from across the flexible packaging value chain, with the aim to make flexible packaging even more relevant in the circular economy. Graham is an expert in this field and provided me with so much insight into the world of packaging. In today's episode, we talk about collection and take back, including EPR, which stands for Extended Producer Responsibility. We discuss the limits to plastic recycling and also about how to design for circular packaging. And not only did I learn a lot about plastics from our conversation, I also walked away thinking that there is a lot to be learned from CFLEX in terms of how to organize circular economy projects across the entire value chain. So, meaning how to get actors involved from a sector, from material producers to manufacturers to end consumers, and of course, what happens post-use. So get ready to be inspired to start your own initiative in whatever industry you work in. And be on the listen for the fascinating reason why Graham and the fellow project members had to put an ongoing plan to measure the composition of waste streams on hold. I'll give you a hint. It's about COVID, but probably not in the reason that you think. Let's welcome Graham to the show. Thank you so much for coming on the Getting in the Loop podcast, Graham. I'm very excited to have you here today.
My pleasure.
Can you just start us off by telling us where you're calling from?
I'm actually in France, calling from my home office. It's in the area of Valence, which is halfway between Lyon and Marseille.
Okay, I don't think I've made it there before. I've been to Nice and...
A bit further north than Nice, Nice is down the coast from Marseille, but if you draw a straight line down from Luxembourg, Nancy, Lyon, Marseille, Valence is about halfway between Marseille and Lyon.
Okay, well, I will have to check that out on a map after we get off of this call. But I'm very excited to talk to you today about CFLEX. Am I saying it right?
That's right.
Excellent. So you've been instrumental in making this happen, and CFLEX stands for Circular Economy for Flexible Packaging. Give us an overview of kind of the aim of CFLEX and how it started.
Okay, you're quite right. What we're trying to do is take flexible packaging materials and make them circular. Right now, in many countries in Europe, probably about a third of European countries, flexible packaging isn't even collected. And where it is collected, only a proportion of it is recycled. It's a very resource-efficient packaging format, but it's very lightweight, which means when you recycle it, you don't get much material back. So if you're trying to meet recycling targets in Europe, you you first focus on the nice heavy plastic items like milk jugs and detergent bottles and PET bottles and things like that, which are nice and big, lots of plastic in them. And until recently, you could meet the legislated targets by just collecting those ones. Now, in today's world, we see two issues. One is that the targets now mean that you have to collect flexible packaging. And the second thing is we have the issue where they are leaking into the natural environment to some degree in Europe, but to a concerning degree in other parts of the world. And those two factors mean that society and businesses in Europe have decided that really what we need to do is go circular for plastics, but in this case, flexible packaging. Flexible packaging being perhaps the most challenging is probably what we call the lowest common denominator. And so therefore, if we fix it for flexible packaging, we're pretty sure that all the other materials, not only plastics, but glass, metals and paper, will actually work within that system as well. So that's what C-Flex is trying to do.
Right. So if you... if you're able to accomplish it for this, then you think all the other types of packaging and things like that can kind of fall into place.
That's right. Yes.
Yeah. So when you say flexible packaging, what does that look like?
Well, we all touch it probably several times a day and use it. So chip packets, candy wrappers, big sheets of polyethylene paper, plastic bags, that kind of anything that really doesn't hold a firm, rigid shape. So if you bend it, it won't actually spring back into its original shape. And they tend to be thin film materials.
Yeah. So like if you get some new clothes and then they come in like a bag from the producer and some sort of flimsy plastic
shopping protector bag, for example, as well. They are included in flexible packaging. There's a lot of non-packaging applications as well. But C-Flex is focused on consumer flexible packaging. So the stuff that you take home or that comes off your products that you buy at the supermarket, back of store, and then gets recycled.
Mm-hmm. And is it just like consumer focused flexible packaging, or is there also a lot of business kind of flexible packaging?
It's a good question. C-Flex is focused on consumer flexible packaging. That's in our in scope. As we get further down the project, we're starting to realize that the systems that we need to put in place for consumer flexible packaging are equally relevant for other waste streams which are flexible packaging, or maybe not packaging per se, but flexible products. Also, things that don't become waste at the consumer, but become waste in commercial or industrial applications. And so why would you put two systems in place when the collection, sorting and recycling is in essence the same? Maybe the collection will be slightly different, but the sorting and recycling is pretty much identical.
Yeah, from an efficiency standpoint, that doesn't seem to make sense.
And as you build scale, you get a range of different qualities. So we are focused on consumer flexible packaging, but we are finding that we're probably going to need to engage with the other non-consumer flexible packaging sectors as well.
Mm-hmm. So I want to talk a little bit about how you imagine flexible packaging looking in a circular economy. But maybe before we do that, could you just give a little introduction to the CFLEX project in terms of who's part of this and what kinds, because I understand it's a collaborative initiative.
That's right. We started back in 2016, December 2016, with a group of 20 companies who were, some of whom were participating in the FIERCE project. That was the precursor project run at TU Delft. I think we had 12 or 15 companies participating in that. And there was a project in the UK we called Reflex, which also had six or seven companies participating in it. They both happened to finish in Q3 2016. And the companies who were participating said, listen, we think we should carry on a European basis and see how far we can get. So with that as a brief, we started CFLEX, took an estimated guess as to what success looks like. And that we said, well, 30 to 40 companies participating from all parts of the value chain, that was going to be a real win. Well, we slightly underestimated that because we're now well over 175 companies. we're talking about all the big brand owners, all the big plastic producers, lots of the end-of-life companies like Suez and DSD, real leaders in the field. We added up the other day, because this gets you traction with the European Commission, that I think it was when we had 150 stakeholders, the combined global turnover of the companies participating in this is well over 1.3 trillion euros annually. So it's become a big deal, and we really have a good balance of representation from all parts of the flexible packaging value chain. So we kind of underestimated that.
Yeah, wow, that seems like a very large initiative, and it seems like it's also growing.
We're still getting new stakeholders. We had another one formally joined today, and there's another couple in the pipeline.
Wow. So in the work that you've been doing, could you give a little bit of insight into what you've been uncovering in regards to circular economy and flexible packaging? Yeah. Like before we started recording, you started talking about EPR systems and things like that. So extended producer responsibility and different take back systems. So I imagine that's kind of what this would look like, but I'm sure there's a lot of nuances that you've also uncovered. So maybe you could give a little bit of kind of the broad picture of how would you envision flexible packaging in a circular economy? And I'm sure there's probably more than one scenario as well.
Yeah, it's not an easy question to answer, because we're still shaping the final picture. When we started this, we were needed to understand what circularity meant for this project. We defined it as being, this was in the first one or two meetings, as being, we collect all flexible packaging in all countries in Europe, and then it all goes into a sorting operation, and it gets sorted into the different material types that then go to the recyclers who recycle those types of materials, and then turn it into recycled new materials that can be reused again by the economy in markets that use them. And that this is affordable, so it becomes sustainable, because if it's cost more than the virgin, then nobody's going to use it. So we have to get the pricing right. We also know that there are going to be losses within the system. Nothing's 100%. So we said, well, if we could get collection, sorting, and recycling each 95% efficient, then that would turn out to returning 80%, at least 80% of the materials to the economy that were put onto the market, which is a huge difference from where we are today. We probably, for flexible packaging, somewhere between 5 and 10% for consumers. So it's a huge step forward. So that's what we envisage the circular economy for flexible packaging to look like in terms of what goes onto the market and what comes back. The first, then we had to work out what that looks like. How do you do that? And we created what we called our roadmap. And part of that roadmap was getting all the different parts of the value chain to talk within their part of the value chain and say, well, what do we think we need to do to help deliver this vision? We then took those five parts of the value chain output and put it together and created this roadmap, which consists of firstly, collect it. Secondly, you have to design it to be a monomaterial stream like polyethylene or polypropylene, so that it's got the best chance of recycling it. So you have to sort it and recycle those streams. The third part was to look at the remaining 20% of the stream, which is multi-material. So it's got a mix of polyethylene, polypropylene, nylon, aluminium foil, papers, all that kind of stuff. And see how much of that could we redesign to be monomaterial, either PE or PP. Because then it goes into an existing system for which we have solutions. We're not going to get all of it. So the fourth part is to look at how we recycle the remaining materials which we can't substitute. And then the fifth part of the roadmap is about making sure that there are sustainable end markets for the fractions that are coming back from the collection, sorting, recycling process. And what qualities do they need? What quantities of materials can they manage? And how does that stack up against the materials that are going onto the market and coming back from it?
Thank you for that overview. I tried to jot down all the different five steps of the roadmap as you were talking about it.
I have a slide which I'll send you afterwards that shows you the five steps quite nicely.
Would it be okay if I also posted that on the website?
Sure. No problem at all.
Excellent. So I was listening to what you were saying in terms of the vision about taking all of the, if all of the flexible packaging in Europe coming and collecting it into one location and then being able to do the recycling there. And I was, it started to make me think about, like, have you discovered that challenges with that? Because I think from a collection perspective, if you're trying to collect flexible packaging or even things that are not packaging, like actual products like phones or computers or laptops, things like that, the collection is such a tricky part because it varies so much depending on like the country, like even, you know, how you deal with different waste streams and how you deal with different things in Sweden is very different than how things are dealt with in the Netherlands, for example. So are these, have you run into things like that in this project?
That's all part of the complexity that needs managing. And luckily that will be dealt with locally. What we have to provide is a model that they can actually use to so that they know what has to come out of the system. Collection is very different in dense urban environments to rural environments. So you do have to allow the local authorities or the EPR systems who manage the system to the flexibility to do it in the most cost-effective way possible, but also to be able to collect all of the materials that are going onto the market. So there is a lot of detail, but at the moment we're still dealing with it at the higher level, providing the overview as to how the collection, sorting, recycling can all work together with sustainable end markets and how you fund it. I think that probably answers some of the question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that I have learned over the last couple of years and my time dealing with circular economy issues is that there's never one simple, straightforward answer, because if there was, then it would have already been done before. And that's what a lot of the devil is in the details is what I like to say sometimes on the podcast, because this is exactly what it is.
I think that's probably one of the reasons why we've got so many interested companies participating, because even the big ones, the very big ones, the Unilevers, Procter & Gamble, Nestlé, Dow's, Borealis, these are huge companies. They've tried to do this by themselves, but they haven't succeeded. So you do need to move as an industry. And that's why people are participating in the project, because they understand the need to collaborate so that the different parts of the jigsaw puzzle can actually move in sync and into a new space.
Yeah, you have to do it at scale, basically, in order to have it make sense from a cost perspective.
That's right, yeah.
So, and I'm now drawing a blank, but maybe you can refresh my memory in terms of EU, like extended producer legislation. Is flexible packaging included as part of packaging?
Yeah, so extended producer responsibility is a thing that the EU legislation put in place probably 15 to 20 years ago now. And it's evolved by country. So we have 28 countries in Europe, or 27 plus, and there's a couple others around the outside. Every single EPR system is different. And some are for profit, some are not for profit. Yeah, it's a very, very complicated area. Flexible packaging is included in all of those, so it always pays a fee to put it onto the market. And then it's up to the EPR system to decide what fractions they collect and recycle in order to meet the legislated targets. The big difference from CFlex is they were saying no targets, 100%. Because we want to go circular, or as circular as possible. And so the big difference is, when you're going for a target, you try and do it at minimum cost. When you're going circularity, you put the cost side to one side, and you say, well, how do we get there? And then once you understand how to get there, then you start optimizing the costs of the system. And that's the fundamental difference between where we are today in Europe, which is very advanced compared to the rest of the world, to where we believe we want to get to in the by 2025, because that's the timescale for CFlex.
Okay, so there is currently EPR legislation that covers flexible packaging, but it's not for, but it has like set targets. And what CFlex is trying to do is go beyond these targets and say, how do we recycle, or try to recycle 100% as best as possible?
That's right.
I wanted to go back to what you mentioned about one of the steps for your roadmap, which was design. And I'm a designer, so I'm really interested in this. And you talked about I believe 80% of the current flexible packaging being made out of mono materials. Did I get that right?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So then the other 20% is of non-mono material
So
products.
you can have a multi-layer mono material, so you can bring functionality into your packaging by using different grades of polyethylene, some of which are oriented, and you can do the same with polypropylene. So you can bring in different elements, but that our definition of a mono material is 90% of that one plastic type,
Okay.
because that's what we understand can be readily recyclable with today's technology.
And of that 80%, are they different types, or are they all? I imagine that they're not just all one type of mono material, right? It could be like, now my plastic is drawing a blank, but it could be like polyethylene, like for one type, and then that's one plastic product is made out of that, and then another type is made out of polypropylene, for example. Like,
That's exactly right. So we have
okay.
monomaterials in terms of PE, polyethylene. We have a monomaterial polypropylene. We have monomaterial papers. We have monomaterial aluminium foils. I think that's we use PET, but normally it's in a combination of in the multi-material sector. The reason is that the PET and the polyolefins don't recycle well together, and so yeah, we don't currently have a solution for that to recycle PET with the with polyolefins, or either PE or PP, and we know that the functionality provided by the PET can normally be substituted by a different form of the PE or the PP.
Yeah, that's quite interesting because it to me it seems like high, that it seems 80% is a bit high, but I guess it is a mixture of different types of materials as well.
Well, it's a mixture of different types of polyethylenes, but when they get to the recycler and they all get melted and re-extruded, yeah, you get a blend of properties, but it's all polyethylene, and it all mixes and fixes, goes together well.
So that comes to the end markets, or like the new markets. So after this step, so what kinds of is it possible for these types of materials to be reused in the same capacity as before, or are we talking about like downgrading them to different or like to different sort of products, the different products than they were before?
There's two parts to this answer. The one is that yes, we can turn them back into films and turn them back into flexible packaging. Maybe not all of them, but they can go back into packaging applications. They can also be used in rigid applications as well. Because they have a very low melting point. They tend to act as the compatibilizers between the other rigid PE fractions or PP fractions, depending on what they are. And so they help the recycling of rigid plastics, but only up to a certain percentage. That's the first part of the answer. The second, and they can also be used in non-packaging applications. The second part of the answer is that flexible packaging has a huge use in the food market. Yeah, I would say probably 80% of flexible packaging is used in food direct or indirect contact. And the issue that we have with PE and PP is that there is no approved recycling process that allows them to go back into food contact. So for mechanically recycled PE and PP, we're looking at non-food contact applications as potential end markets. Thankfully, there's this new beast in town called chemical recycling, where we actually take the materials and back to their original building block, which was the naphtha that goes into the plastic making process, and we remake the virgin material, and then those materials can be used in food contact again because there's no difference between them and virgin materials. So as we start building capacity and capabilities in that space, and we're starting from a zero base, we'll see that plastic makers have an alternative source for naphtha than fossil fuels. There'll be some naphtha coming back from the recycled plastic world.
How far out do you think we are in realizing that?
There are already examples, there are already pilots operating at the moment at scale, like 10 to 20,000 tons, and there's quite a number of them. I think it's going to be 5 to 10 years before we see significant quantities of this capacity being on the ground. We're also trying to find a balance between how much we can chemically recycle, for which there are end markets, and how much there needs to be chemically recycled because we have this need for virgin. And it does the virgin doesn't only have to come from flexible packaging; it can come from rigid packaging as well. So the, we we That's one of the parts of the jigsaw puzzle. We're busy running trials to find out who can use what and in what quantities, and the balance would then be going to chemical recycling.
I know, if I'm not mistaken, you're planning some industrial scale trials, but maybe that's not for chemical recycling, maybe that's for something else.
No, the industrial trials we're planning are to get enough materials for our stakeholders to actually run real products on their lines so that we can test things at scale. So we're currently starting a trial. We're looking to run 2 times by 50 tons of material. So it's which is actually quite small scale in the bigger scheme of things, because in Europe, we think there's about 3.7 million tons of flexible packaging going onto the market every year. And here we're talking about 50 tons. Or 2 times 50 tons, some polyethylene and some polypropylene. But then when you sort it all out and you get the different fractions, you only end up with a couple tons of each fraction, and then you have to divide that out between the people who wanted to run trials on it. So that's why we're doing industrial trials. Also, by doing that, we can prove that the stuff we know happens at pilot scale can also be done at real scale.
So is that testing for quality or how
Everything.
well it performs in products or, yeah.
So also the costs associated with doing it, and also when you're cherry picking for pilot or lab scale testing, you might not get a representative mix of waste. Also, the mix makeup of the waste stream changes with the different times of year, and so that's why we're trying to do it at scale, so that we have a much more representative set of results in terms of the yields and the costs associated with that.
Yeah, Jeff Worcester was on the
Oh,
podcast
yes.
in yeah, you know him. Yeah. And of course in the plastics world. And he was talking about in December you have a lot of wrapping paper, for example, and all of these types of packaging from Christmas gifts, and he's talking about the different cultural effects of waste and plastics packaging, and it just really it's very obvious when you start to think about it, but you don't really think about it from that perspective often. And I can only imagine now with COVID, the rise of surgical masks and gloves and things like that. It's a whole different ball game.
Yeah, we actually are in the process of running compositional analysis, where we go and hand sort different waste streams, so stuff that's separately collected and municipal solid waste streams in a country, and then document what's coming back with which waste stream and what quantities and stuff like that. Well, we had to stop it for 2 reasons. Firstly, nobody was allowed to travel during the pandemic, and secondly, the waste stream is not representative anymore. So we And it costs a lot of money. So we've had to delay it. We'd hoped to have all the results by end of June this year, but we haven't done our first sorting trial yet. That's scheduled now for the end of September.
Yeah, I can also just imagine thinking too, now everyone has changed their habits, so maybe people are eating out less, so there's a lot of less of these types of flexible packaging from different sort of consuming out kinds of things. And yeah, it's crazy how just like that, all of a sudden the waste composition could change.
Yeah, well, I mean, I used to travel several times a week between countries, and yeah, since the middle of February, I haven't been anywhere. So I mean, even my usage consumption patterns have changed drastically. Also, where the waste becomes waste is quite important, and the stream that it comes back with.
Yeah, that's true. Now it's probably moved to all of the individual households as opposed to offices and transit stations and things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I know that you've also done, and I keep coming back to design, but I'm a designer. So you've done some work with like design guidelines for a circular economy. And I think some of the listeners might be interested in hearing about that. Maybe you could just tell us what they are and the work that you've done in that area.
So when you go into the space as a designer, especially in countries where flexible packaging isn't collected, sorted, and recycled, you don't take that into consideration because you're designing it for the functional requirements of the product. So now in a circular economy, you have to add another set of design requirements to your product or your pack's design because it's going to become circular and you have to get the materials back. So what the purpose of our design guidelines was to distill what's important, what can be recycled, what can be sorted, and to write all of those requirements down for the different types of flexible packaging out there. So that the designer can then look at the guidelines and say, okay, now I understand I have to design the pack to deliver in terms of recyclability as well as the product's functional requirements. So that's what the design guidelines are. They're easily downloadable on the CFlex website. There's three different versions of it. A simple table for people who want an immediate overview. There's what we call the executive summary for management who needs to understand perhaps a bit more detail. And then we have the real deal, which is for the designers who actually also want to understand the reasons behind why you need so much materials in a pack, why you don't mix material sorts, and kind of like the hierarchy of decisions and trade-offs that you need to make as a designer, which I'm sure you know very well.
That's brilliant. I'm going to link to that in the show notes website, so of course then everyone can check that out. And I think it's for me, I'm smiling really, really big here too, because it reminds me of a project that was started in, I believe, like 2012 maybe, and it was called The Great Recovery. It was based out of the UK, and one of the things that they did was they took designers to municipal waste locations, like recycling centers and things like that, and they had them talk with the people who work there and explain, like, okay, well, this type of plastic, because it's this color, this is a problem with the sorters that we have, and yada yada yada. And I think it's something that I have been looking for kind of since then, in terms of some like clear guidelines of how to do it. So I think what you've developed is really really good in that direction.
The interesting thing about it is that it's probably the first guidelines that I'm aware of that were developed with input from all parts of the value chain. So the people who make the plastics, all the additives that go into those plastics, the converters who print and laminate and blow the films, with the brand owners who have the product requirements top of mind, and with the recyclers, the collectors, sorters and recyclers who say, well, we can't do that, or yes, we can do that, or sometimes we can do that. And also the EPR systems as well. So it was a huge team. It started off at about 20 people, but by the time we finished, I think the team looking and compiling these design guidelines was well over 150. So it's pretty robust. There are some small differences with some other guidelines out there, but minor differences. And when you get into the detail, you realize it's because we're talking about consumer packaging, and some of the other ones are looking at other applications which are more requiring in terms of levels of purity of materials. But generally speaking, they're very much aligned. We've launched phase one, which focuses on the polyolefins and paper and the other monomaterials. But we're busy working on phase two, which is looking at the 20% that we haven't covered, to work out how to recycle those and what the impacts of those are on the sorting and recycling. Can we sort them out? Can we recycle them? Do they impact the quality of the recycled product? So there's a lot of those things that we just don't have data on. It's just not available, so we couldn't include them in the first lot. We're also looking at clarifying some of the principle or the things that people say, oh, you can't do metallized, you can't recycle metallized films. Well, it turns out you can. and we're putting the data in place to show that they are able to be sorted. And if you recycle them, there's no impact on most of the applications that you want these things to go into. So there's a lot of hearsay. And because we couldn't find the facts to underpin that, we're busy doing the testing now, and we'll bring out a phase two, which will complete the guidelines. But then once we've done that, we have to relook at all of them, because the technology is moving so fast in terms of mechanical recycling and chemical recycling and sorting. So these things are going to be reviewed, I think, at least annually into the future, definitely until we reach steady state and everything's circular.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I find it really inspiring that you created these and developed these guidelines with the entire value chain, because I think that's often like the key part. You have different actors who are working in silos, and really in order to actually make the change happen, it has to happen across while bringing these different actors together. And I also really like that you're busting these myths, so to say, about, well, what is this actually true or is this not true, and what's the status on that? Yeah.
It has a dual function, and I think this is one of the other functions of CFLEX, is that it's educational as well, because by having this discussion in a cross industry perspective from different parts of the value chain, you start to understand the issues from other parts of the value chain's perspective, not just your own little silo. And so there's an education or a building understanding benefit that comes out of the process, and that's not to be underestimated. Similarly, for CFLEX, building this vision as to what the circular economy for flexible packaging looks like and how we're going to get there, everybody has the same vision. So they understand in a lot more detail what they have to do, and it's incredibly powerful. And we're hoping that it enables us to really ratchet up the speed with which we can deliver the circular economy.
Hmm. Speaking of education and creating awareness, I think this is the perfect segue to the question that I ask all of the guests that come on the Getting in the Loop podcast. And it's the final question that I usually ask. And I find it's a great way to wind down the interview, because it kind of sets the stage in terms of the vision and the things that you would like to see happen next to really, in your case, to really make this circular economy happen with flexible packaging. So the question is related to the In the Loop game. And this is the game that I created to engage people in the topic of circular economy. And in the game, you're a product producing company and you have to travel around the world collecting materials. So right now it's focused on the 12 materials that are found in the periodic table of elements. So a little bit different than what the topics and the materials that you're used to dealing with, because these are things that are like antimony and beryllium and indium, tungsten, cobalt, not exactly probably found in flexible packaging, but more so in, sorry.
Because most of them are heavy metals.
Exactly. You don't want those in there. So they're not found there. But sometimes they are added to different things as additives. So you have these types of these materials, and they're found often in electronic products, technology products. And in the game, you have to collect these materials, but there's different challenges that come. There are also different opportunities that come, and they come in the form of events. So they change the market conditions in the game. They can either help or they can hinder the players in collecting these materials. And a lot of these events kind of make them start to think about, maybe I should go circular. So my question for you, Graham, is if you could create an event for the game, what would you focus your event on?
not being that familiar with the game, but it sounds fascinating. I would probably suggest, and I don't know whether it must be some sort of recycling part to the game because it's you're going circular. I don't know whether you have the requirement in when this recycling event happens for the person who draws the card or has to make things happen, that he has to go around the other players and get them to voluntarily agree to paying into an EPR style system to make to fund the whole recycling system and to make those recycled materials cost competitive with Virgin, and then make that contribution every round of the game. So it would be quite interesting because it becomes a level playing field for everybody. Yes, your costs go up, but actually it becomes part of the product cost, and it's the consumer or the who's buying the end product who's paying that. So for you, it's as a product producer or a brand owner, it's not. It's not coming out of your back pocket. What you're doing is including in the product cost and taking that money and then putting it into a pot of that enables those products to be recycled, collected, sorted, and recycled. So I think it would be quite an interesting debate amongst all the players to say, okay, well, I drew this card, guys. We're going to set up a recycling system for antimony. That's going to cost us an extra 1,000 euros a year per player, so we can't go forward with this. All you guys, you're going to be using antimony, and all those you guys who aren't going to be using antimony, but maybe use cobalt or something like that. Let's agree to put this in the pot and fund it, and see what happens because it is a collaborative requirement to go circularity, to go circular, and. I think it would be an interesting twist to the game. And maybe you can have a different levels of high recycling than circular. So are we prepared to actually fund the whole thing? Or is that too much for us in one step? Do we have to do it in 2 or 3 years? So that's, I think, would be an interesting twist to the game. I also think it would be an interesting twist to make a version of the game for packaging because that's not that simple. But for people in the field, that would be quite educational.
Yeah, I was imagining like the different levels that as you were talking in terms of, okay, we have different targets and how are we going to hit these different targets, for example. But also for the plastics, I mean, I think that could be such a interesting way, and also combining what you've done with the design guidelines, trying to incorporate that into, some sort of game where we gamify that and have to, have these different actors in the value chain, and there's different criteria, be like, well, based on the contents of the design guidelines, for example. And so, well, if you do this, then you're only going to get this amount back. But if you were able to redesign it according to these different criteria, then you could be able to, go more circular.
With this version of the game, you could also have a clock, which is a fixed time. If you haven't solved the problem with setting up recycling and making it circular by 2025, you're probably not going to be allowed to use that material anymore. So it adds a you just time out, nobody wins. And it's like, oh, we should have done that better. Let's play the game again and see whether we can make it work.
Yeah, that's a now it's my turn. We've been talking to we've been talking a lot. It's the time running out factor is quite interesting. And a lot of times when people finish playing in the loop, they always turn around and say immediately, like, I want to play again because if I had a chance to play again, I would do X, Y, and Z differently. But yeah, you don't really get a second chance in life all the time. So
Well, that's why it's important to gamify it. And the other interesting thing that I've observed in CFLEX is that as the group gets bigger and there's more people expressing opinion and you need to take the time for to bring people with you. You can't just leapfrog steps. You need to bring everybody with you. You can't do it too fast, unfortunately. Even if you throw money at it, it doesn't work because you don't get the buy-in that you need.
Yeah, and I imagine that if you're also constantly having new people join, then in some ways you might feel like we're taking one step forward and two steps backwards because then we have to get these people up to speed to have the buy-in. I don't know, but if have you found that to be the
Critical
case?
mass now, where the new ones are the smaller part of the whole, and they normally get brought up to speed by others quite quickly. So it's less of an issue than it was in the beginning. In the beginning, it was, well, we have to go back to square one, and so we actually offered a quick crash course in how we developed the roadmap and the different elements of it and actions and stuff like that. We
Yeah, I
don't.
find communication keeps popping up as something that really needs to has a significant role to play in having making sure everyone's on the same page, especially in these different types of large initiatives. So, but thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Graham. It has been such a pleasure to talk with you, and I'm going to link everything that we've mentioned in the show notes, but can you just say where listeners can go to learn more about you and the topics that we discussed?
If you want to learn more about me, my LinkedIn profile is well out of date, so don't bother going there. But our CFlex website is www.cflex.eu, not .com, .eu. From there, you can get to the design specific website as well. Yeah, we're ramping up our communications initiatives. We wanted to have something to talk about before we went public and said, this is how we're going to do it. But we really are putting a lot of effort into getting the message out beyond the CFlex stakeholders into the whole value chain and in other material sectors as well.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. For show notes and links, go to our website at gettinginthelooppodcast.com. And while you're there, subscribe to our mailing list to have new episodes delivered to your inbox every Monday. See you next week.